Welcome to the Terawatt Space Podcast. This is Arvind. In this podcast, I attempt to demystify the developments in space tech by interviewing thought leaders, entrepreneurs, and investors in the space industry. This episode is all about Earth observation, starting with what it is, what its applications are, and the importance of satellite data. We also discuss the challenges in the sector today and why, if you're an investor, you need to consider investing in Earth observation. Sit back and enjoy. Today, I'm speaking with Joe Morrison. He's the head of product success and impact at Umbra Labs, a space tech startup based in California that is building a constellation of microsatellites with radar sensors to produce all-weather day-night imagery with sub-meter resolution for low-cost distribution via an integrated web platform. That was a lot of technical jargon, but welcome, Joe.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm so excited to be on. And I'm so excited that you're doing this podcast. It's a long time coming.
Thanks. Thank you, Joe. Before we, you know, start explaining the jargon that I just read out about what Umbra Labs does, it'd be good to know, you know, your story. Who's Joe Morrison? I'm sure some people, some listeners know of Joe from a certain blog that you wrote or tweets that you tweet out. But what's your story?
Yeah, I broadly, this podcast is covering space technology, as I understand it. And so I took a pretty traditional path to getting into the space industry. I went to a small liberal arts school. I majored in religion. I think I took one like biology course. I took a math course in college that was like math for students who are a disappointment to their parents or something like that. I mean, I have no STEM background. I just kind of stumbled my way into the industry backwards. And a big part of that was that in college, I was really interested in entrepreneurship, and I had started a business in college and it hadn't really gone very well, but I'd met a lot of interesting people. And I realized I wanted to kind of apprentice under someone that really understood how to run a great business. I eventually landed at a company in Philadelphia, Azavia, where I spent the better part of five and a half years. And I got to see firsthand the CEO there at Azavia, Robert Cheatham, is an amazing entrepreneur, built a business without ever raising venture capital, millions of dollars, 50 plus staff. And it just happened that that business was focused on building software for mapping. And a big part of Azavia's ethos was investing in research and development, which is kind of incredible because, you know, you think a 50 person firm, no venture backing, and they're spending excess cash on research and development is an amazing place to work. And I learned a ton. And while I was there, we won a grant from NASA to work on satellite imagery analysis software. This was like 2015, I want to say. And around that same time, there was some venture capital coming into the space. There, 2014 maybe was when Orbital Insight and Descartes Labs and a bunch of companies just got formed. And there's a lot of excitement. Oh, there's this new deep learning technology that you can apply it to satellite imagery and you can extract all kinds of information about the Earth. And so I just started learning about it and got the opportunity to work on this really fun project at Azavia, building a generic platform to process satellite imagery. And through that, I met all the satellite imagery vendors. I was trying to buy data from them, trying to analyze data with them, do partnerships with them. And you alluded to my writing. I started writing last year when I was getting pretty frustrated with the industry because there was so much potential, so much hype, so much money coming in. And I was just seeing very little output in terms of real problems getting solved. And so I started writing about that frustration of the industry feeling backwards, feeling broken, feeling difficult to work in. And one of the people that read that writing was a co-founder of Umbra, where I work now. And he reached out to me and we started talking like I've had conversations with a bunch of startups now that get me really excited about the space. And I realized a lot of people felt the same way. And not only did they feel the same way, but they were starting businesses to modernize the satellite imagery industry. And at the same time, and I'm sure you'll have them on the podcast, people are revolutionizing the way you get to space, the launch vehicles that are going up. There's new companies popping up focusing on that. There's companies focusing on building like modern SaaS software for managing constellations once they're in orbit and preventing them from colliding with other satellites and, getting all their telemetry data and making sure that they're staying on orbit and tasking them in certain directions. So it's kind of cool to see software eating the space industry at the same time it's eating every other industry. Mm-hmm. But that's my story. I kind of accidentally found this really interesting world and started talking publicly and realized that unlike a lot of highly technical fields, this is an industry where everyone's nice to you by default. Your competitors are curious and nice to you. Potential partners are curious and nice to you. It's kind of a secretive industry, and I'm trying to change that and get people to talk publicly about what they're working on and why and what their experience actually is. But once you meet people, you realize like, yeah, there's kind of like a space nerd component to it where people have always wanted to work on rockets, that kind of thing. That's actually a pretty small proportion of folks in the industry. Most people just want to work on something that's meaningful and helps humanity in some way. Unlike a lot of places where people who are deeply technical wind up delivering food or, making an algorithm that serves ads more efficiently, something really satisfying about working in an industry that's got, aspirations of going to space and looking at the world from space. And so it's a really satisfying field to be in. And I think I'm in it for the long haul.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, it's good to know that there is space for, people in the space industry who are not even from the traditional background. I think I'm also an example for that. And there are so many people who do not have any background. And I keep telling people that, it's not really necessary. Before we get into, this Earth observation, I just wanted to, get your perspective on what is Earth observation? I thought, space technology is all about rockets and, SpaceX and what's going on with NASA and going to Mars. So yeah. What is Earth observation? It's kind of a, self-explanatory name, but what is this field that, we keep talking about every other day?
Super deceptively simple name for a very complicated and fuzzy field. because one definition of Earth observation would just be using sensors to measure the Earth from above. And so in my definition of Earth observation, that includes drones. It's not just satellites.
Absolutely.
It includes weather balloons. There's amazing companies like Near Space Labs that are taking high quality aerial imagery of the Earth from balloons. So it's not just space. It encompasses more than that. But space is a big one. And part of the reason for that is that if you have sensors on orbit, you can look anywhere you want and you don't need anyone's permission to do it. That's one of the cool things about space is if there's a world power that is using their power for oppressing a certain population, if there's a humanitarian issue, you can't just knock on the door and go fly a drone and see what's going on. But you can fly a satellite and go look at what's happening. Earth observation, it's not just imagery. That's the other thing. Observation connotes visible images, like you're observing the Earth, but it's all types of instrumentation. And there's actually right now is an interesting time to be talking about it because there's a bunch of technologies that are sort of just on the horizon or just being really commercialized. Synthetic aperture radar is one that's been around for a long time. That's the field that I work in. We can talk about what that is specifically. That's kind of being commercialized. It's not a new technology, but it's suddenly becoming accessible to a broader audience. And then there's things like what Hawkeye 360 Inspire do, RF signals, where they're, GPS radio occultation and these like crazy newfangled sounding technologies where they're just measuring radio signals passing through the atmosphere. And that allows them to measure all kinds of interesting things like the temperature of the atmosphere, the moisture content of the atmosphere. So it's not just pictures of Earth, although that is the predominant, like where people spend their money in Earth observation. But yeah, it's a super exciting field. And I think in large part, like part of the reason that I'm so excited about it is that we are facing a massive humanity-wide climate crisis. And in order to make effective decisions about land use and resource allocation, you need information about what is happening on Earth in order to make informed decisions at humanity scale, basically. And I don't see an alternative to Earth observation for a lot of the information that you need. And so I imagine it's only going to get more critical as time moves on, and there's going to be more interesting companies and more interesting types of sensors. So that would be my sort of broad definition of it.
No, absolutely. That I think that makes for a good, let's say, high-level understanding. But what I wanted to understand was why now? Why, what's going on now? You know, rockets have been going on since, you know, the 50s and the 60s, sending satellites up. What's changed now? You know, we've been collecting data about the Earth, I would imagine, from the 70s and the 80s. So what's new about observing the Earth right now? Is it the sensors, or is it the, you know, the number of satellites that we can launch? So the type of technology we can test, or, you know, what's new in Earth observation?
Yeah, the one thing that never changes is the physics. The physics never change. So it's the same lens you use to capture an optical image of Earth today that you used in the 70s during those early missions, where they were like sending film canisters down and catching them in airplanes. And, you know, now it's luxurious that we can just send a downlink to a ground station and resolve an image all in this virtual digital environment. It didn't used to be that way. It used to be physical. So that's gotten easier. But in terms of why now, I mean, I just mentioned the climate crisis as a huge motivator personally for why it's an exciting field to be spending my time on. And I think a highly leveraged way to spend your time if you're interested in technology. So there's a need for it. There's a desperate need for it. But in terms of what's changed to enable a bunch of new value to be created, there's a few things. One is launch. So, you know, people love companies like SpaceX. You see Elon Musk on the TV all the time. Elon Musk is, he's helped them raise a lot of money, sure. But there's somebody named Gwynne Shotwell that runs that business day to day. And there's thousands of people that work tirelessly at companies like SpaceX to build new ways to get to space that are cheaper and more efficient. And that is bringing the cost of launching down significantly. And there's other companies like Astra just made the news. They're going to go public through a SPAC here. Rocket Lab. There's a bunch of these companies that are making it cheaper to get to space. And at the same time, you've got supply chain, global supply chain getting more efficient. So you can, you know, your secret sauce and your satellite, it might just be one tiny component and everything else is off the shelf. And that's not always been possible. In the 90s, when the first U.S. Earth observation satellites were going up, they had to like custom order everything on that satellite. And these things weighed like several tons. And so they were spending tens of millions of dollars on just like parts, spending hundreds of millions of dollars just to get to space. So that's all become, I wouldn't say commoditized, but, you know, companies like Blue Canyon, there's a bunch of interesting folks working on the actual parts of satellites you need to construct them. So that's making it cheaper. Of course, the cloud computing revolution has made the cost of storing data and analyzing data come down dramatically. The complexity too. You don't have to have your own data centers now. You don't have to have your own ground stations to receive the information. That's all becoming virtualized. And this is a big caveat. Just because everything is coming together at the same time and that, you know, machine learning techniques like convolutional neural networks and deep learning generally are making it easier to analyze this data, it's not going to be an overnight revolution where we suddenly realize all the potential of Earth observation for a few reasons. One is that legacy providers of Earth observation haven't changed their business model. So I always say, like, if you want to buy satellite imagery today, you've got some great idea. I want to model wildfire spread more effectively with satellite imagery. I want to model water access to water and water rights. I want to look at agricultural patterns. Well, good luck buying some satellite imagery that's high resolution that you can task. It's like harder than buying a house. And so you can't get it. There's just not enough capacity from a commercial perspective. And so if companies like Umbra, which are trying to change that, trying to make it an easy, affordable experience to get high resolution, timely data anywhere on Earth, if we're successful, then right now is the perfect time to be getting into this industry. And if we aren't successful, if the satellite blows up when it's going to space, if, you know, we run out of money and all of our competitors run out of money, which we've all raised a boatload of money, so I doubt we're going to run out anytime soon. But if we somehow can't pull it off, then it's not a good time to be getting into this industry, because you'll have all the solutions, all the plans, all the software ready to go, and you will not be able to get the basic data you need to be able to do all those cool things. Because, yeah, that's still a constraint on the growth of the industry. So it's getting cheaper and easier than ever to build these companies, and that means that it's going to drive price down because supply is going to go way up, I think. But it hasn't happened yet. And people were portending that back in 2014, 2015, when I was just starting to get into the industry. They said, it's like next year, there's going to be more satellite imagery than anybody can handle. And here we are 5-6 years later, and there's still nowhere near enough satellite imagery to provide the kind of like economics necessary to build all these businesses that should be built on top of this information.
Yeah, no, absolutely. The business model is something that we will get into in a bit, and, you know, looking into the challenges with the industry. I just wanted to get one thing out of the way. People have been asking me, I think something like this made the news as well recently. Can you look into, you know, somebody's house with images from satellites? You know, can people track you? People, you know, keep asking questions like, you know, you put satellites up and, you know, it's only for spy purposes and there's no use. And, you know, they're kind of scared that they're, you know, they're being watched or their houses are being watched. And I think that was an article that was recently became viral, unfortunately, which not true. But, you know, is that really true, though? You know, just wanted to get your perspective.
Yeah, I think I might surprise you a little with my answer, but it absolutely is true that synthetic aperture radar can see through certain materials and can see inside of certain buildings. They're not the buildings that you live in or go to work in or experience in your day-to-day life. They're things like temporary structures at refugee camps. In fact, if you try to image like all the plastic structures at a refugee camp with synthetic aperture radar, oftentimes it just shows up invisible because the radar passes right through it, hits the ground underneath and bounces back. So yeah, you can see through certain structures, but not in any way that's relevant to most people's day-to-day life, and certainly not in a way that is considered helpful from an intelligence gathering standpoint, except in very specific contexts. So, the other thing to think about is resolution. Like, I think people don't understand the regulatory environment that satellite companies are subject to, at least in the United States. It is bonkers. The NOAA regulates remote sensing companies. That's the term remote sensing. Sometimes used interchangeably with Earth observation, but NOAA is officially given the responsibility of regulating remote sensing companies. They do that in conjunction with the U.S. Department of Commerce because you're selling a good that is a regulated good. It's considered an export when you sell it internationally, and satellite imagery is all over the world, so there's lots of people internationally that want to buy it. So that's another regulatory body. The State Department also has a hand in regulating remote sensing companies, often acting through the Department of Commerce. The DoD has responsibility for regulating and helping setting policy around this, because they have national assets. They have capabilities that aren't commercially available that they want to protect. The FCC regulates these companies because you're sending information from space, just like the communication satellites are. So that's another regulatory body you have to work through. By the time you go through the list of all the government bodies that are regulating satellite imagery to make absolutely sure it's being used responsibly and in a way that's both ethical and legal, that these companies aren't spying on you personally. they're under a mountain of regulation to make sure that the way that they're operating complies with US law. And there are people that have spent their entire careers thinking about fair uses of civilian satellite imagery. I mean, this is not a new concept for the US government, and they are very effective at regulating it. We can talk separately about whether they're over-regulating it or moving too slowly, as companies in Europe and China and Italy and Japan start to really threaten U.S. dominance in this space. But I say that because, yeah, it is possible to see through buildings with current technology, not in any way that is scary to me personally as an individual, not at any resolution that I feel like could be used to personally identify someone, not in any meaningful way. So hopefully that answers the question.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is a question that comes up a lot, even, you know, with people who are looking into investing in companies because they don't want to invest in unethical companies that, you know, spy on people. And I tell them, you know, it's they have other things to worry about, you know, in terms of the big dangers that they're going to be subjected with.
I do worry about the ethics of what we're doing actively, mm-hmm. though. I don't want to downplay that, yeah. Because that is, people have studied, for instance, GPS trace data off of mobile phones and the ethics of working with that data, mm-hmm. Very deeply. I don't think the same can be said of open research on civilian remote sensing. There's regulatory actions that are being taken and protecting military interests. There's a lot that's been done there. But if in 2 years from now, someone can log on to Umbra's website, task a satellite that captures an image at 50 centimeter resolution over, let's say, their ex-wife's house, and find out whether or not her car is parked there, you know, it scares me about what the implications are for people using this data in a nefarious way. And I think I will always be scared of that. And I have to believe that making this data more open and freer will be, like, the good will far outweigh the bad. People using it for humanitarian purposes will far outweigh the nefarious uses. And we're going to have to find ways to police for that if we can. But it's not an easy discussion when it comes to the ethics of these things. And there are just, you can come up with hundreds, maybe thousands of nefarious uses for it. And it's really hard to know how to screen for that. So it is scary, but I think it's a risk worth taking on because of the potential positive impact that having this data accessible to a broad audience will have.
Yeah, absolutely. I think in terms of the conversation, I think we need to keep that going. And, you know, it's also good to have that in the back of our heads as, you know, as you and, you know, the other players in the industry design these distribution platforms that make it easy for people to access satellite imagery. You know, these are things to keep in mind before, you know, before developing them, you know, in the way Silicon Valley did with everything that is going on with the app economy. Going on to the, you know, the applications. So what do we do with all the data that's being collected? You know, that you see a lot of news about some applications more so than the other. But can you talk about some applications that you have worked on personally with satellite data? Perhaps you can even touch on, you know, the most surprising ones that you worked on, you know, ones that have completely baffled you that satellite data can do this, something like that.
Yeah. In my job at Azavia, I worked on lots of satellite imagery projects, most of them were, you know, there's an irony when you're a professional services firm that produces a lot of open research and open source software. Everybody hires you and then puts you under NDA. One of my favorite projects, for instance, there's a researcher at Clark University named Lyndon Estes, and we were just a very small component of helping him with his research. We were basically processing Planet Labs imagery. So Planet Labs is an Earth observation firm. They have more satellites in orbit than anyone else. They're taking an image of every part of the landmass of the Earth every single day. We're just a wild company, really impressive, amazing company. Lyndon was taking that information, annotating it, so hand labeling it, and then using something called consensus scoring to basically take multiple people's interpretation of the image and find the consensus interpretation of that image to do really complicated inference. So he was basically like drawing field boundaries in Africa. Like, imagine there's probably hundreds of thousands or millions of small holder farmers in Africa that have, you know, a couple acres that they farm for subsistence farming and maybe also selling some cash crops out of that. There is no definitive map of where all those farms are and what they're growing. And you can't physically go out and survey all those people. Now, there's interesting use cases where people are like using texting and texting surveys to get information. But what Lyndon was doing was automating the mapping of field boundaries across Africa. That is fascinating because you could build so much on top of that. You could give that to the government to help them set policy around agriculture, to help them direct funds or direct subsidies if they want to get resources to those folks. That was a really interesting one. To give you like a totally different one, that's like foundational mapping is what I call that use case, where there's, you know, a lot of people don't realize because they use Google Maps or they use Apple Maps and they think the world is mapped. Most of the world is not mapped at all. And so just extracting foundational features, where the parks are, where the roads are, where the farms are, that's one great use for Earth observation data. And I would say mostly that's a use case for optical imagery. Contrast that with a more time-sensitive use case where it's not a foundational map, it's an active monitoring use case where you're tracking something that's changing quickly over time. One example of that was a project we did with a client mapping the effect of a tornado as it passed through a town and mapping where all of the destroyed homes were. And you run into these funny use cases or edge cases, like the deep learning model. I remember in that use case, it got confused because there were so many blue tarps over the roofs of destroyed buildings that sometimes it would see a property that was totally unscathed by the tornado, but it had a pool in the backyard, a big blue blob, and it would think that's a damaged building. Because I've learned that when I see blue, I know that's a damaged building. And so that was another good one. And I mean, imagine if you're FEMA or if you're a state responding agency, in the hours after a tornado passes through, just knowing what's the map of the damage, there's no way to do that besides Earth observation. And they're actually flying oftentimes aerial missions to do that, but you can task a satellite from space to get that image. Those are just like two examples that I think are nice categories. Foundational mapping, so that you're sort of prepared to make policy or make decisions or combine that with other data sets, versus monitoring, where you're actively looking at something that's changing on the Earth and trying to figure out a decision or a mitigation strategy. And there's a million of these use cases that fall into those two categories.
Great. I think there are plenty more applications of Earth observation. These are, you know, very nice examples that people would appreciate listening to, because sometimes all they think is Google Maps and that's about it. And that's Google and that's Earth observation. Well, they do, you know, they do make money out of it, the satellite data providers, but that's not where the big money is, you know, as we know from the industry, there's so many more applications that, you know, we can get into with Earth observation. I wanted to go into the, you know, this is basically what we can do with Earth observation. All this is great. So satellite data is, you know, going to become available more and more. What are the problems? So what's going to, you know, what's going to be, you know, what's needed to be happened in the next few years in order to get there? Because what we are painting is a picture that something is possible now, but more is going to be possible in the next, let's say, 3 to 5 years. But what needs to happen in your perspective to get there?
Yeah, well, I feel, I mean, the reason I started at my current position last week, so I'm a veteran. I think I'm on like my seventh or eighth day at the company. The reason I joined Umbra is that it felt like a maybe once in a lifetime opportunity to directly influence the first thing that needs to change in the industry, which is there need to be satellite imagery providers who make it to space and start operating a constellation and start streaming data down, who aren't beholden to a single dominant customer. So that could be in MDA's case, that's the Canadian government. In Maxar's case, that's the US government. In Cosmos' case, that's probably the Italian government. There's almost always some sponsoring government body that has a sweetheart deal where they pay a bunch of money and they get priority access to all that data, and they can kind of pick and choose, and there's just scraps left over for everybody else. What we're trying to build at Umbra, and what a bunch of other startups who are launching companies or launching satellites and successfully making it to space and streaming data down, what the vision for this new generation of companies is that there is no priority customer. It's first come, first serve. It's self-service. You don't have to talk to a salesperson. You can get data if you want it. It's transparent pricing. That's a revolution in this industry. That's how messed up it is. You can find out what somebody lists a house for. You can't find out what they sell their satellite imagery for. It's nuts. Like, no efficient market operates this way. So step one is making an efficient satellite imagery market. And that's what I'm dedicating my career to at the moment. When we are successful, we will be successful at doing that. And there's plenty of competition, transparency, modern distribution of the data. Any software engineer that's interested can get started using this data. Once we reach that stage, which we're not at yet, but we will, I mean, we're talking in the next 5 years, we're going to be there. Then we're going to enter the second phase, which I call the big crunch, which is there will be no customers for it. Great, we solved this problem. You can now order the data. There's not enough people. There are plenty of software engineers who can process this data. Plenty of data analysts, data scientists who can figure out how to extract information from it, who can kind of crack that nut. That's getting easier and easier by the day. It's not easy, but it's tractable. The huge problem that we are facing is that not enough entrepreneurs from domains understand what's possible to do with this imagery and what will be possible once it's truly accessible and cheap. That's where we need to recruit people from insurance, people from agriculture, people from disaster response, people from literally anything that has assets on Earth that can be observed from space, where you can make better, more informed decisions if you had timely information constantly about that asset, which is like almost every industry. We need people to start businesses incorporating remote sensing data, Earth observation data, analytics that are derived from it into user experiences, products that serve those customers, where the key litmus test is for your customer, do they have any idea you were able to provide that timely information and help them make that decision because of a satellite on orbit? And if they have no idea that's how you did it, and that's fine by them, they just care about the information, then you've got a real business. And once people start building those things, they're going to be extremely profitable and they're going to feel like magic to the end customer. How did you know that? How did you know when that shipment was going to arrive? How did you know like how much water was going to pass through this hydrological dam and how much energy we would produce next week? How did you predict that? It's amazing. I meet new entrepreneurs all the time, probably two or three a week, that are starting these businesses. But so rarely are they coming from the industry where they're trying to solve the problem. And that is the thing that takes years to build up, like the domain expertise, the network, the ability to convince people that what you're doing is real and warranted. It's coming from the software engineers into those industries, and it should be coming from those industries to go recruit software engineers. That's not happening currently. And so that's like my big message, like where we need to focus. And that's part of why I love this podcast and your mission, demystifying space technology. You know, that it sounds so scary, the words synthetic aperture radar, GPS radio occultation, like it sounds so scary. Other people can figure that out. What they don't know what to do is how to apply it for something that's valuable. If you're somebody listening to this podcast, working in an industry where you're like, oh, shoot, I think we could automate this thing that's really hard for us to do manually in the field with Earth observation data, you've got a gold mine. You just got to go mine it. And you can find people, you can recruit people to do the technical part. But they're having a really hard time finding you. So that's what my kind of stance is on it.
Great. There's a, you know, like an open call basically for people, because we do really need people from outside the industry, because I really do believe, you know, I call, you know, the space bubble of people who stay within the, you know, the space industry and kind of think, I mean, I'm not faulting them, you know, it's just the way, you know, they've been, and it's the same with the Earth observation industry. And I hope that, you know, more people outside the industry get in, because it's the same thing that happened with the software industry. It's, you know, people, there are only a bunch of people who knew how to code. I think when I was doing my computer science undergraduate degree, I felt like a, you know, kind of a superhero, because I was growing up back in India, and, you know, to code, that's great. And, you know, that was kind of, well, today, you know, everybody knows how to code. But I think in a few years, I hope that there are a lot of people who kind of start businesses figuring out what to do with this new type of data. And, you know, I call that the iPhone moment for the industry. And, you know, because there's going to be so many applications that we can develop if, you know, if everything that you said works out, you know, if there is transparent pricing, if, you know, the cloud costs continue to go down, which I believe they will. And, you know, the deep learning models continue to get better again, which is, these are all assumptions I think that we can make. And where does Umbra Labs fit into the puzzle? Because you mentioned, you know, I read out when I was reading your, you know, quick bio, I gave a lot of jargon to people about a distribution platform and, you know, day-night imagery, sub-meter resolution and all that. So how do you see Umbra Labs fitting into the whole future that you're talking about?
Yeah, I think the important thing to understand about where Umbra fits in, which by the way, we've rebranded to just Umbra. We dropped the labs. Okay. So it's just Umbra, which is an ominous sounding name. It means shadow in Latin. Yeah. But I think it's actually an allusion to the umbrella type action that the satellite antenna takes. It starts off fold it up, and then so you can make it really tiny, make it really cheap to get to space, and then it sort of unfurls like a transformer once it's in space, and it unfurls like an umbrella. So Umbra is interesting because it's the first company I've ever met, and that's why I joined them, that is taking this approach where we are not building out an analytics team. We are launching very cheap to build and launch satellites that are going to produce very, very high quality data. And that's a whole podcast unto itself, how we're able to achieve such high quality data in such a cheap form factor. I shouldn't say cheap. It's not cheap, but it's just, you know, historically these missions to do sub-meter imagery and optical imagery, in large part because of the physics of optical imagery, you need a big lens and therefore you need a big bus and therefore it costs a lot to get these things to space. In synthetic aperture radar, radar generally, you don't need as big a form factor to resolve very high resolution imagery. And so it's just cheaper to get to produce this imagery. But what's unique about Umbra, and what I hope it's the first of like a full generation of startups that do this, is that we are not building out our own analytics team. We are not selling priority access to customers. We are basically providing a clean foundation for people to build businesses on top of with no ulterior motive. So, because one of the big issues with some of our competitors is that they have large analytics teams. So if you take this imagery and you have a great idea, we're going to use this to monitor carbon stocks for carbon offsets. Like, you bought a bunch of carbon that's supposed to be in trees. How do you know the trees are still there? How do you know they didn't get blown down or caught fire? Well, you can monitor them with remote sensing. Great. If that works and you're working with somebody that has their own 20-person analytics team, guess what their first thing they're going to do is? They're going to tell the analytics team and say, why don't we offer a product to do this? And I've seen this over and over. Maxar has done this, the largest optical imagery provider in the United States. Planet has done this, the second largest optical imagery provider in the United States. Our competitors in synthetic aperture radar, iSight and Capella are the two main ones, but there's a bunch. They all have these big analytics teams. And when you say the iPhone moment, it's prescient. Because what happened when the iPhone launched? Some genius made a flashlight application that would turn the flash on permanently. Version 2 of the iPhone came with a flashlight utility. Whoever that app developer was got completely wiped out overnight. That's what's going to happen when you build your company on top of someone that builds applications on top of their own data. They will always be their first and best customer. You will never be their first and best customer. So part of what I feel passionate about is that there have to be companies where the economics work out to where they can be a big, profitable business just providing data, just delivering data. And my focus, my job at the company is user experience. So what does it feel like to buy data from us? And I mentioned earlier, buying satellite imagery today is harder than buying a house. Our vision is to make it as simple as booking a hotel room, like booking an Airbnb. You log on to a site, you don't talk to a salesperson, you pick your area that you care about, you look at what's available, you choose what you want, you see what it costs, you decide whether or not you want to pay for it, and then boom, you hit a button and it's done. And that is, I feel like, only possible because we aren't additionally pursuing this analytics strategy where we're trying to own as much of the value chain as possible. That way we will never compete with our partners. We will never compete with our customers. We will be the best possible vendor that we can be with the fewest ulterior motives that we can have. And that's what we're trying to build. And I think that Umbra will be one of the first to achieve that. But I think there will be dozens of others to come down the line in hyperspectral imagery, in optical imagery, in RF. And some of those companies may have already been started and be successful, and they'll sort of pivot to that business model once they see they can make it work. But that's where I see Umbra fitting into the broader trend of what's happening in the industry and why I joined them specifically.
Sounds good. I hope that, you know, that sounds like a very nice future to have for Earth observation. For those who are wondering, you know, how they can, you know, kind of get into the Earth observation industry, because it's kind of a niche industry. You know, you have software engineers who know how to develop apps and, you know, who use Java and all that. But this is a different game. You know, you need to, you know, learn to understand geospatial data and maps and, you know, be in a different, let's say, specialization. So what can they do? You know, what's there for people? You know, you mentioned, you know, you come with your ideas, you know, with your domain expertise, but what else can they do? Do they need to know how to work with satellite data in order to get into the industry, or what else can they do?
Yeah, so it depends on your personal professional goals and your aptitudes. But I would say that if you can learn how to build software, you should learn how to build software. Forget Earth observation. Learn how to build software. I mean, it's no coincidence in my mind that that's your background because it gives you maximum optionality. So that's number one. And I am not a programmer. I have tried to learn how to program. I'm terrible at it. Maybe eventually I'll get the hang of it. My wife, who's an English major, is a QA engineer, taught herself to program in like 6 months. She was off to the races, had a full-time job. Now she's doing that as her career. So I know what it looks like when it clicks for somebody. It did not click for me. But that's okay, because I can focus on product requirements, on interviewing people, on qualitative feedback. I can focus on sales and promotion and education. I can focus on customer support. I can focus on translating these difficult to understand, jargony sounding concepts into something that's easier for someone to understand. And so I would say the main thing, though, is being laser focused on how you want to apply this technology for good in a very narrow and specific and in a way that you can articulate easily. And so if you have that, then it's pretty easy to go find resources to get started. There's a bunch of open data sets that exist today that didn't exist 10 years ago. There's a bunch of cloud computing companies that are starting new initiatives around this. Microsoft AI for Earth is one. Google Earth Engine is another. Earth on AWS is another. Like, they'll just give you free credits to go process this data and try to use it if you put together a nice email to them. And so, I would say it's more accessible from a technical standpoint than ever. But what remains difficult is having a compelling story to tell to get people's attention about why they should put resources towards you or why they should connect you with people that can help you on that mission. That's the thing that's hardest to come by. And the only way to come by that is lived experience. You just go work in an industry. You know about this in the back of your mind. You're thinking about it constantly. How could we apply this to make our lives easier? And then you will find opportunities. They'll kind of come to you.
Great. That's for people who are, you know, looking to get into the Earth observation industry. What if I'm an investor? You know, I've listened to all this conversation. It's, you know, I've understood a little bit of it, but not a lot because it was too technical for me. And, you know, I usually invest in property and, you know, but I'm exploring some options and there are some Earth observation companies either trying to build satellites or trying to make sense of data that comes from satellites. You know, sell them to me. Why do I need to invest in them?
Yeah, I mean, I think actually this is one industry where venture capital can have a really big effect on what the industry looks like in 10 years. It's not going to happen on its own. And part of what I feel strongly that Earth observation data, the archival information that's been captured over the years, the information that's going to be captured over the next 10 years, the signal to noise ratio is actually pretty good, but the information we're able to glean from it is terrible, paltry. There's just so much interesting insight stuck sitting on servers right now, and that will be produced and never exploited for anything in the future. And it takes venture capital type risk appetite to unlock that information. But it's like the opportunity is so enormous, it's hard to wrap your mind around. Because you're able to measure precisely anything on Earth anywhere, the question is, what's the data set you combine that measurement with to arrive at some fascinating insight that seems like magic to your users and your customers? And if that's not interesting as a VC, it's like this really difficult technical moat that you can build around a very particular and potentially very lucrative industry. Many of these industries, logistics, insurance, agriculture, they're ancient. I mean, they're like most of the world's economy that you can go and build solutions for. That seems like a massive opportunity to me. And anybody that's not at least open to the idea of these vertical specific SaaS type solutions that could be built on top of some analytical workflow derived from Earth observation data that has never been accessible in the history of humankind, but is about to be super accessible over the next 5 years. Like, if that doesn't sound like an opportunity to you, I genuinely don't know what would. That would be my pitch.
Maybe rockets, I suppose.
I mean, rockets. So here's, honestly, if I can sort of take the other side of this, building rockets and launching them is like building cars. Like, that's going to be not a great business to be in. And sure, Tesla stock is super high right now, but Ford's isn't. And so that is not as interesting to me. Like, if I understand the venture capital model correctly, you want high margin, like 90% margin businesses. Those are software businesses. There's no other business like that unless you've got some illegal racket set up. So the software businesses, the venture type businesses, they aren't getting invested in right now. Like, there's a lot of need there. While the launch vehicle companies and the rocket science companies and the people building parts are getting billions of dollars in investment, it makes no sense to me. I'm happy for it, though, because you can't have the SaaS products get built unless all that infrastructure is invested in. But long term, I think like the next generation of really great companies, they aren't going to be they are not going to be hardware companies, in my opinion. They're going to be software companies. And I say that as someone who works at fundamentally a hardware company, because I know that promised land will never arrive there unless people build the infrastructure necessary to get there. But yeah, I would say that to me, that's the most interesting place to be paying attention as a venture investor. As an entrepreneur, though, start whatever resonates with you, because you don't have to raise venture capital money to build a business. I worked in one, like I said, for 5.5 years that was amazing and made the founder wealthy. And he shared all that wealth with all of his employees. And we got to work on cool things. Like, you don't have to raise money to be in the Earth observation industry or the space industry generally. So I would also keep that in the back of your mind.
Absolutely. That's a great pitch for you VCs who are exploring opportunities in Earth observation or generally in space tech. And, you know, there are some parts of space tech that are good to go get into. And, you know, there are others probably not so much. Okay, cool. Last question. You know, going out of the Earth observation, let's say, bubble, going into space tech, what are you most excited about in space? You, let's say you are, you know, you are a newcomer into the industry because, you know, you worked at a geospatial firm, like you mentioned, which was, you know, which was kind of, you know, had adjacent applications with satellite data. But looking into space tech from the outside, what excites you most and what are you looking forward to in the next 5 years?
The kind of cool technical thing I'm looking forward to is probably hyperspectral data. Mm-hmm. And so hyperspectral data is just highly refined spectral bands. I'm trying to think of an easy way to describe this. When you go to the paint store, you go to Home Depot and you give them a paint sample and say, can you match this paint sample? They use a hyperspectral imager to characterize the exact color and composition of that paint to then match it. That hyperspectral sensors like that in space looking at Earth allow you to do things like tell the species of a tree inside of a forest or tell the exact soil type over an area. So they're kind of funky because the data is huge, multidimensional. They don't look like images typically because they've got oftentimes like hundreds of bands. But there's a new NASA mission going up, Hyperia, I think it's called, in 2022. And there's a couple commercial companies trying to build hyperspectral stuff. And the thing I always say about hyperspectral is it allows you to do what everyone thinks you can already do with optical imagery. Like, oh, you can like track this, you know, you can characterize this forest, or you can, you know, look at this land use cover type. So that's probably what I'm most excited for, because that's a new, to use a jargony term, phenomenology. That's what they're typically referred to, but a new modality for Earth observation that has historically been done at very high cost on aerial missions, like $1 million aerial missions. And once it's in space and streaming down, you'll be able to do it much more cost effectively, I hope. So that would probably be the thing I'm most looking forward to. And when you pair that with other phenomenologies like optical imagery or synthetic aperture radar, the field that I work in, I'm sure there's going to be interesting opportunities to do what they call, another jargony term, sensor fusion, to combine these different data sets to arrive at really interesting insights.
All right, cool. I think that we have come to the end of the conversation. I always like to ask one final question, which is, if you had the chance to send one sentence in an email to everybody in the space industry, or in your case, in the Earth observation industry, what would be that one line?
Wow, that is... You've heard me talk during this podcast interview, right? I'm not a one-line kind of guy. I wish I were. I think my sentence would be, we're in this together, probably. And what I mean by that is we're not competing with each other. We're competing with no one using this data for anything currently. So let's be kind to each other and support each other and lift each other up, because a rising tide lifts all boats. I think my message would be that we're in this together.
I think that's That's a great message to end. And, you know, hopefully we start making more use of Earth observation data in the next few years. And thank you, Joe. Thanks for coming on the podcast, and good luck. Good luck with your new role at Umbra.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a blast.
Hey, this is Arvind again. Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, please subscribe to the TerraWatt Space Podcast on your favorite podcasting platform. Also, feel free to sign up for my newsletter, TerraWatch on Substack. That is terrawatch.substack.com, where I attempt to decode the recent developments in space tech and its impact on Earth. Thanks again, and hope to see you for the next episode.